This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Are you troubled by silence? Marcel Marceau made a career of it. He was the most famous mime the world has ever known, and yet his life was one of surprising extremes, from his youth as a French resistance fighter to the heights of celebrity and ultimately to work that caged him and his art into a stereotype. Sean Wen became fascinated with the life and career of Marcel Marceau. She pored over interviews, films of his performances, records of his possessions, and realized that in his silence, he was shouting to be heard and remembered. Sean has written a book of lyrical essays called A 20-Minute Silence, followed by applause. And you may recognize the name Sean Wen as a former producer on The State of Things. Sean, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
This book, this kind of fascination with Sean, with Marcel Marceau, I can imagine you pitching this at The State of Things, saying, this guy's amazing. You should know more about him, right? Is that how he came to you? I mean, how did you find, what grabbed your interest in this guy?
I actually became interested in him when I first read his obituary in 2007. So when he died, I remember reading it and finding out about his childhood, which basically ended at age 16 with the Holocaust. He and his older brother were given, his entire town was in Strasbourg, so kind of the border of France and Germany. They had an hour to evacuate. So they left with 60 pounds of belongings each and fled. And I was really fascinated with this idea that he lost his father in the Holocaust. He fought in the French Resistance. And then after that, he had this career as the most famous mime of all time. And I was kind of interested in that dichotomy, that split in his life. So that's when I started looking into him.
So tell us about how he found pantomime.
So he was, as a child, obsessed with silent film. He talks all the time about kind of like sinking into the theater and watching Charlie Chaplin perform on stage. And so when he started performing, he just had a real fluidity, like a natural articulateness with his body. And he was kind of coming up at this time when there was this sort of like revolution in French theater, where there was suddenly a lot more attention being paid to the body. And he took it to its natural extreme, as it were.
But it's interesting because you would write about his teacher, De Crew, is that how you said it?
Yeah, that's right.
Who was interested in pantomime, but from a very different point of view, right?
Yeah. So De Crew was a man who's very, very serious about art. In fact, I think he's quoted by saying, like, art should be serious. So there are funny stories about De Crew performing entirely in the nude because he was very intent on the audience being able to see his body in all its natural glory. And there are also stories of De Crew interrupting performances and lecturing the audience about not paying enough attention right. to him. But he really created sort of like the alphabet, the logic that Marcel borrowed from the rest of his career. But what's kind of interesting about De Crew is that he was not himself a very, like, quite as expressive a theater performer.
And didn't he? I mean, that was his theory because he was, and I know all this from reading your book, but he was attracted to sculpture and mm-hmm. thought in many ways that mime shouldn't have a narrative, that there should be something kind of abstract and therefore difficult. You know, he's one of these kind of artistes, right, who thought mm-hmm. that the more obscure it is, the better it must be, I guess.
That's right. Like he, I think he was very disappointed in Marceau for creating this very populist form full of little narratives, little sketches.
Marcel Marceau very much wanted you to know what was going on, right?
Absolutely. Like there's not very much room for interpretation. It's almost crystal clear what he is doing and what you're supposed to get from it.
Let's talk about the form of this book, too. You've got these neat little essays and in some cases, artifact lists of things that he owned. Tell us about the way you constructed the book.
Well, I constructed it very much as a collage. The genre lyric essay means it's a hybrid of poetry and nonfiction writing. And at first, it was just like kind of like a jumbled mess of facts and ideas and little poems that I had written. And the form began to make sense to me once I started to write sort of these poems that have nothing to do with Marcel Marceau, these poems about the sensory experience of sitting in a theater and watching a man with a body much more articulate than your own moving in front of you? Or what is it to refuse speech? Or what is it to listen? Or what is it to observe? So once those were put together, and those kind of like leak in my point of view more than any other section of the book, the rest of it sort of fell into place.
Well, let's read a section, and I say let's because I'm told I'm taking a part in this. Am I right?
That's right. I always read with someone else doing the voice of Marcel.
Well, I'm doing this mainly because I have the chance to actually give voice to Marcel Marceau on the radio, and this is probably my only chance to do it. So, so I'm happy to play the part. So I will be speaking the parts of Marcel Marceau.
That's right. So I'll begin. Marceau on speech.
I don't suffer from silence. I could be 2 days without speaking. I wouldn't suffer at all.
Marcel Marceau's first wife divorced him in 1958. She said he would not speak to her for days on end. She called it mental cruelty. He called it rehearsal. His third wife, Anne Seco, called mime his only way of thinking and expressing himself. But then Studs Terkel said, only one guy out-talked me, Marcel Marceau. I couldn't get a word in. He used his hands as he spoke. There used to be a rumor that he was a deaf mute. He dispelled this rumor by appearing on talk shows. Johnny Carson, Flip Wilson, Merv Griffin.
I'm obliged to talk. I don't like to talk especially.
But Marcel Marceau had a reputation. Those who conversed with him found his conversation as entertaining as his stage performance. His English was nearly flawless.
I think I'm not so different from other people in my private life, except that I don't like very much to socialize. I'm rather a person who is on his own. I like to paint, I like to read, to write, and to travel so much, you know.
There's a joke that Marcel Marceau released an album. The record consists of 20 minutes of silence, followed by applause. Marceau on Marceau. Marceau liked to recite lines from his own reviews.
Marceau explains why theater exists, where it comes from, and why it will be with us for a long time.
But that's not what the critics said. Walter Kerr actually wrote, Marceau really explains where the theater came from, why it is going to last a very long time, and why we like it. Kerr did not write,
Marceau explains why theater exists.
That was Marceau on Marceau.
So there is a reading from 20 Minutes, 20 Minute Silence, followed by applause. These are essays by Sean Wen, and it's on the life and career of Marcel Marceau. Tell us about his life, because you mentioned his three wives. I mean, the fact is he really abused his family in support of his own career.
Yeah. Famously, even now when you hear interviews with, I mean, there are not very many interviews with his family, but they do mention that he was performing 200 shows a year, 300 shows a year, basically his entire life. I was really interested in that idea that he would have his family decimated in the Holocaust. And then when he created his own families, he essentially abandoned them.
Creating these various persona. Bip the Clown, I suppose, the most iconic figure that he created, right?
Right. And Bip is very much kind of an everyman sort of figure, modeled. He claims it was modeled after Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp. Bip also borrows a lot of tropes from a figure called Pierrot, which is kind of like this classic, sad, moonstruck dreamer sort of a character.
And this is a character, this part of the story of Bip, I think, contains within it the story of, in some ways, Marceau's own destruction. He creates a character that is accessible to every man for all time, and therefore will never change it.
That's right. I think one of the, I'm asked often, do you think that Marcel Marceau was successful or not? Which is kind of an interesting question, right? Because he, on the one hand, is the most famous mime of all time. All of our ideas of what a mime is, all of our cliches, that a mime is French, that a mime has white face paint, that a mime wears a white sailor suit, those are all Marcel Marceau. At the same time, though, he made us hate mime, as it were. I mean, all of my associations with it growing up were of like anvils and hammers and safes falling on them from Warner Brothers cartoons, right? I think that in some ways, you could also argue that he's a very tragic figure, that he failed in his mission because he opened the door, became the mime, and then closed it behind him.
Yeah, I mean, one of his most famous scenes was the scene of the cage, right?
That's right. So as I've been, you know, kind of promoting this book, and I say, you know, I wrote a book about mime, almost immediately everyone starts doing the man in the box me. And what's funny is how sad that story actually is, that it is a story about a man walking along on his way, and then he slams into an invisible wall, and he can't see it, but he can feel that he's stuck. And so with his hands, he starts to try to feel along the perimeter of that wall. And what happens is he gets further and further into this maze until he realizes he's trapped in there for good, and he dies crumpled in this enclosed space. It ends up being a really appropriate and sad metaphor for what mime has become, right?
And he, in large part, is responsible for that, refusing to change or expand his own repertoire. Did he become aware of it? Were there critics or friends who were saying, Marcel, you know, you're becoming your own caricature, you must change?
I think that he was aware of it to a certain extent. In the book, I quote some interviews where a journalist asks him, why do most Americans hate mime? And he says, well, that's because most mimes are lousy. And then he says, the journalist asks him, what do you think of street mimes? And he says, I guess it's better than mugging people. Like, I think he had the sense that mime had become stale. And he was very concerned with legacy. I mean, he created a school. He trained students intensively in the hopes that he could create a mime theater that would outlast him. But instead, what happened was he died and took everything with him.
Took everything with him, and that wasn't much. He died essentially penniless and left his family penniless, except for his artifacts, which you detail in the book.
Right, right. So he spent a lot of money financing the last shows of his career because he was traveling with a mime troupe, because he had these trained students that he took on the road with him. And he accumulated about €500,000 in debt, which the French government seized and sold forcibly at auction. And so for me, this was, you know, basically I had written most of the book when I found these catalogs of all of his, you know, so many of his earthly possessions. And I felt like it was just, as a journalist, like too big a treasure trove to give up. So I spend a lot of time kind of like teasing through this list of objects and trying to make sense of it.
Were you able to make sense of it? Did it come together as a narrative?
I think so. I mean, yeah. I think that they're kind of dispersed throughout the book as these little like insights into him, and then there's a payoff with the auction.
With the auction. And does it give you any broader insight into what was going on with him? I'm just wondering, at the end of his life, did he feel he was a success?
Well, I think that, I mean, part of why I wanted to create, include these lists is because there's something very 20th century to me about traveling the world over and over again and basically ransacking it of its worldly treasures, right? Of like, you know, like prehistoric Mexican sculptures or Chinese ivory statues or, you know, paintings or daggers from Morocco. There's something very funny about kind of like cherry picking these objects from all over the globe and then bringing them back into your house, especially now that we're in an era where the great Western museums are returning artifacts to their native countries. The fact that it was literally broken up and dispersed item by item, I think was very sad for his family and for his loved ones.
What about, is there a legacy? I'm thinking, and the only group that comes to mind is the Blue Man Group. Is there anything that at all, I mean, and mime certainly is. I mean, it is the butt of more jokes. I think comics have made whole living on making jokes about mime. But is there a legacy at all? And is there any kind of genealogy that we can follow from Marcel?
I think that remaining mimes are trying to piece that together right now. There are a number of mime performances that still exist. There's probably the most successful group that I can think of is called Mumenschanz, which is a European group. Mm. But otherwise, I think that for his contribution to the art might be enclosed in him. But that said, I mean, he did really affect our visual culture. The book details how Michael Jackson's moonwalk is modeled after his walking against the wind. And like I said, you know, everything that we associate with mime is basically from his own career.
So, and he was an absolute genius in that kind of physical comedy. Hard to think of anyone who could do as well.
I agree with that.
And I wonder about the French, too, because one of the other great joke that comics used to like to make all the time is, you know, sort of whenever France came up, they'd say, yeah, but they love Jerry Lewis, you know, and they did. But when you think about him and some of the other great film stars in France, the idea of physical comedy, and this goes back to his own teacher, was a very important idea in France, the idea of bringing your body to the comedy, which is what made Jerry Lewis a success there. He brought his body to the act in ways that Americans may or may not have appreciated as much.
Yeah, I think that during that time, there was this idea that theater had become stale, that actors were like basically these sacks of potatoes standing on stage, relying mostly on their face and their voice. Mm-hmm. And that was what brought on this movement of focusing solely on the body.
How is he remembered in France?
I think that he has a mixed legacy, that there are many people who love him dearly, who still feel very attached to the art, that who are wishing to revive it, but they're not entirely sure how. And as a result, I mean, many people there think that Americans love him more than French people do.
Sean Wen, former producer on The State of Things, now a writer and a producer, too, working in San Francisco, and the author of A 20-Minute Silence Followed by Applause, a book about mime, Marcel Marceau. Sean, great to see you again, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You can find out more. She's going to be reading tonight, by the way, Letters Bookshop in Durham, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced these days by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.